Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, ordinarily introductions are supposed to ease the speaker's way into the audience and to warm them up. I'm paralyzed by this one. I feel, first of all, completely exhausted by all the trips I just took. Secondly, as I notice the speakers between whom I'm bracketed, I can't help but be impressed by the extraordinary amount of wisdom and direct practical experience which a number of your past and future speakers have. It's therefore with some trepidation that I move into this material. Trepidation born also partly out of the fact that while I do not offer myself here as any specialist in the construction of policy designed to facilitate the relations between Negroes and whites and achieve the goal of equality, I should pretend to have a body of specialized knowledge that would be relevant to the construction of such policy a little more easily than it could be done in ignorance. The fact of the matter is, however, as you recognize along with me, that two things stand in the way of my being able to rest on that kind of expertise. The first is that much of the research is not directly relevant to the immediate battleground. And the second is that even if we had all the knowledge in the world, as we'll see later, there is no way of going from all the knowledge in the world to any single decision as to what ought to be. I mean, even if we knew all the possible consequences of our behavior, we would still be involved in making choices which were not guided by that knowledge, but only informed by it to the extent of knowing the consequences. With that much of an introduction, I venture to plunge into an effort to examine some of the reasoning on both sides of the desegregation question, which may have underneath it certain errors and fallacies, misconceptions, and lack of understandings of the respective points of view, the greater understanding of which might indeed facilitate the construction of a more peaceful and easier policy toward the commonly desired goals of equality for all. Coming from Princeton and seeing the controversy that the so-called Princeton Plan evokes in the question of desegregation, I want to warn the audience in advance that none of the experiences we have had in Princeton with the desegregation issue are transferable to New York City, except one general caution, or if you will, one general facilitator, one thing that makes people able to breathe easier once it's truly experienced, and that is that in most social change, and it was true in the Princeton situation, much less happens than is feared beforehand. It's not always true. Sometimes much more happens than is feared. But I think it's significantly true in the majority of the cases of proposed change in the relations between people who have been put into unequal situations that much less of what people fear actually occurs. For whatever comfort that may be, this is exactly what was the experience in Princeton. A different kind of situation has arisen in Princeton. Just 7 days ago, a group of students on my campus announced the formation of a new organization called Students for Segregation. And their avowed purpose was to tell the truth, quote, about Negro-white differences, and to demonstrate with that, quote, truth, that not only was a demand for total and immediate desegregation or integration of the schools, not only was that demand not justified by the facts, but indeed there was a serious question, said these students, as to whether any desegregation could ever be justified. One should hasten to say that the response to this organization from other students, faculty, and administration was such as to discourage all but the most hard-bitten of the hardcore. But that's not important, and in any event, it would not be a very meaningful observation, since it is characteristic of the true believer, wherever he is found, that he flourishes on opposition and hostility, especially if it's public. He's beautifully well insulated, the true believer is, by his faith, whatever its psychological origins. He's insulated against the possible impact of contradictions, whether these be contradictions of his moral point of view or of the so-called evidence that he offers in support of that point of view. Now, what's more significant about these students is that they were in part inspired and assisted in their activities by a Princeton alumnus whose name perhaps some of you know, Mr. Carlton Putnam, who has for some years now been speaking and writing on Negro-white relationships, and who has codified everything he has to say in its precious little in a book called Race and Reason. It's not about race and it's not about reason, but that's the title. From time to time as well, Mr. Putnam and others issue smaller publications, and they're juicy because they're taking on all the characteristics you would expect that they would. They are inclining toward authoritarian politics, toward anti-Semitism, toward all the things that go into a crackpot point of view. From time to time, these people issue smaller publications under the imprimatur of the National Putnam Letters Committee, which operates courageously out of a box number in New York. Now, while Mr. Putnam by himself is not of very much significance, he is a symptom of a rather significant and disturbing new attempt to reopen and reaffirm old saws about race differences. And this attempt seems to be able to grow so long as misinformation and falsification of scientific evidence about race differences are permitted to go unanswered. Now, I don't mean to be so silly as to suggest that when one demonstrates that some claim about race differences is false, that those who hold this idea are going to drop it or are going to drop the basic feelings they have about race. But I do mean to say that I think it is important and sometimes crucial, and today it is, not to permit such persons to lay claim to a factual basis for their points of view without fear of open contradiction. I think this is important for two reasons, among others. First of all, those whom we may call racist, meaning by that term now those who advocate separation of Negroes and whites on some notion that there are inherent, unbridgeable differences between the two groups, those racists have recently felt it necessary, ever since the Supreme Court decision in 1954, to counterattack against the movement toward desegregation by trying systematically to subvert the point of view held by most sociological, anthropological, psychological scientists about the insignificance of Negro-white differences. Now, in so doing, they have obviously responded to what they felt to be the very convincing nature of the scientific evidence, at least as far as the court and a large number of the public at large responded to that evidence. The feeling that it's necessary to underpin a racist point of view with so-called evidence in support of that point of view is an interesting turn of events, because it leads the argument about desegregation and integration out of the moral and the ethical area, and I'm later going to suggest that that's where it ought to be returned, and suggests instead that if indeed the factual claims of the racists are not substantial, they will come to feel bereft of a factual justification for their point of view and will once again have to resort to what is clearly a generally unacceptable set of demands based on an unacceptable set of ethics. The second reason I think it's important to question the factual claims of the racists is because they represent the more overt expression of what I think are the private beliefs of any number of other people whose political and ethical convictions, or timidity, or both, will not permit them openly to avow their beliefs in so-called Negro inferiority, but who feel uneasy, nevertheless, in the face of the open assertion that there is this inferiority, and who feel weakened in their ethical predilections for desegregation by the fact that they privately believe what the racists openly preach. There's a third reason, too, and it's becoming just as important as the necessity to take the factual ground away from the white racists. And that is, it is important to take the factual ground away from Negro racism. Not only the more egregious forms, such as among the black Muslims, but that whole range of thinking and expression in the Negro community, which in reaction to the doctrine of white supremacy has counter-advocated a cult of negritude, with its defensive and self-destroying insistence on the race, the rights of the race, using terms, in short, that give credence to the idea of distinct and separate races, and in so doing, causing themselves endless harm. Now, I won't attempt here to recite the substantial body of scientific evidence regarding race differences that seem to me unquestionably to refute the white and Negro racist points of view. I will, however, urge on this audience, to the extent that they may have questions in their minds about these matters, or to the extent that they feel unable to respond informedly and strongly to claims made by racists, that they study carefully the excellent evaluations of these latest claims of white racists, which appear in a book called, the evaluation that is, appears in a book called Race and Intelligence, published by the Anti-Defamation League. I had the challenging and interesting opportunity to edit that volume. I get no royalties. That volume consists of responses by four distinguished scientists to questions I put to them regarding the soundness and the validity of Mr. Putnam's book, Race and Reason, and the book on which he and others, such as Professor Henry Garrett, used to be professor of psychology at Columbia, and Dr. Wesley Critz George, professor emeritus of anatomy from the University of North Carolina Medical School, who has recently put together one of the worst jumbles of non-scientific mess one ever saw, the book on which George and Garrett and Putnam rest much of their case, namely a study, a doctor's thesis by Dr. Audrey Shuey called The Testing of Negro Intelligence. Now, I asked these four scientists whether there were any good grounds in these new, so-called new documents on which to question the conclusion reached by a group of the most distinguished sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, and geneticists in the world at a UNESCO conference, conclusion to the effect that, quote, wherever it has been possible to make allowances for differences in environmental opportunities, the tests have shown essential similarity in mental characters among all human groups. In short, given similar degrees of cultural opportunity to realize their potentials, the average achievement of the members of each ethnic group is about the same, unquote. The answer from the four scientists as to whether there were any new grounds on which to revise this judgment was uniformly and strongly no, and this was after studying all the so-called new evidence. There is no reason to question this statement, they answered. In fact, the four scientists were in substantial agreement that the claims advanced by Dr. Shuey, Mr. Putnam, Professor Garrett, and later by Professor George, cannot be supported by any scientific evidence. Now, let's get this straight about what the evidence says. The evidence does not prove that Negroes are equal in native intelligence to whites, but nor does the evidence prove that the Negroes are unequal in native intelligence to whites. In fact, the tests don't prove anything about native differences, simply because we don't have tests of native differences. Not only don't we have tests that measure native capacities, but we don't have distinct biological groups called Negro and white to compare. For these groups are defined not in genetic terms, as they must be, if we're to make any sense out of further testing of their genetic differences, but rather in social and cultural terms. More than that, we have never satisfactorily equated Negro and white cultural backgrounds so as to make sure that the results that come out of any testing, assuming we had tests, will truly reflect native differences and similarities and not be contaminated by cultural differences. And these conditions, a real test, which we don't have, separate biological entities defined genetically, which we don't have, and equation of the conditions of cultural and social life, which we've never achieved, and will never be able to achieve so long as there is a distinct concept called Negro and white, because even if we equate all economic, cultural, and social situations, if there is a group called Negro and recognized as such, it will be suffering a residuum of imputed inferiority in this culture, which will reflect itself in the performance of children on tests. So with these three conditions, absolutely must be met if any claims regarding native differences between Negroes and whites are to be tested with any validity. One must immediately add as follows. In the absence of any valid knowledge about native differences between Negroes and whites, and in view of the extent to which the differentials between them on test performance alter in the direction of equality when the cultural differences are reduced, except for one special set of circumstances we'll discuss later, probably the best, the most conservative, and the most scientifically valid basis on which we can operate is to say that the groups called Negro and white represent people who have been socially and culturally set apart from each other, but who for all purposes of common participation in this culture would best be thought of as having an equal range of native talent among their members, an equal range. Now that's one thing one must add, but one more important thing to add, I think, is the following. The possibility remains open that if and when we do control the contaminating cultural variables, and if and when we do get tests of native capacity, and if and when we do get distinct genetic groups called Negro and white to test, there is every good reason to entertain as equally possible that the test will show that Negroes and whites are equal, or that Negroes are inferior to whites, or that Negroes are superior to whites. It's crucial to keep these three possibilities in mind, for what follows is the question as to whether we would alter our notion as to what is proper and just in the relationships among the two groups if we were to discover any one of these possible outcomes. Suppose it were definitely to be established that the people called Negro are natively much brighter or natively much more stupid than whites. Would we then conclude that it is therefore correct to have segregated schools? I think not. I think that with few exceptions, we would wish this judgment as to how our schools should be constructed to rest on what we think to be fair and proper from an ethical point of view in a democratic society. I'm suggesting here, ladies and gentlemen, that the new racist efforts to revive race separation and to legitimate it on presumptive grounds of scientific evidence of differences between the two groups must be counted on two scores. First, that the evidence claimed on behalf of separateness is not there. And secondly, that even if it were there, it would be irrelevant, for it would not be the basis on which to dictate what was a correct policy in a democratic society. No single inch of ground in democratic social theory permits any consideration at all of the justifiability of such separation, whatever the evidence about different capacities may ultimately show. Now, closely connected with the argument that urges separation of Negroes and whites on the grounds of differences in their capacities is the argument that advocates separation on the grounds of psychological, social, and cultural advantages and disadvantages and differences, even when these differences are grudgingly conceded to be due to differences in background. The usual counterargument to this, namely the counterargument to the one that says let's separate them because of the psychological problems involved, runs that it is bad for Negroes and whites to be separated because of the psychological consequences, bad for whites because of the larger gap in understanding that is created, and because of the loss of exposure by white children to diversity that contact with Negroes might bring, and bad for Negroes because of the ego injury. But this seems, too, to me, not to be a very sensible basis on which to argue. I know that the court decided for desegregation on the presumptive ground that separate schools were inherently unequal because it said the separateness wouldn't necessarily produce psychological harm and hence lowered capacity to perform in the Negro child. But here, however right I think the court was to make the decision on any ground, I think that it was a most unfortunate choice of grounds on which to rest the decision. Can anyone really make a decisively persuasive case that it is psychologically better, all things considered, for Negroes and whites to go to school together or separately? From whose points of view? Which psychological results does one have in mind? How shall we evaluate and measure the relative weight of one's loss against one's gain? How shall we evaluate the short versus the long run effects? No, I think that ground, too, is too insecure a ground on which to rest the claim to equal rights in the schools. The ground that can withstand all argument to the contrary is the ethical ground, the one that holds that in a democracy it is our obligation to see to it that groups are not separated by skin color lines and assigned different classes of citizenship and separated from effective contact with each other. It is education for democracy that gives us the imperative. The relevance of integration for such democracy is factually demonstrable, but the ultimate justification of the desirability of democracy is ethical. And no facts can prove that we ought to prefer the democratic form to others. There is no such proof of ethical imperatives. They are given by the nature of our premises as to the good society and our views as to just and proper behavior in that society. It is on those premises that we find our ethical standards and our ethical strength. Thus, when it comes to deciding how one will vote on such questions as to whether to bus a number of children back and forth in order to mix them up in the schools, one has to decide, it seems to me, on the basis of how committed is one to the principle of equal rights as against the balance of possible losses to other values that one may suffer, losses of convenience, losses of peace, losses of possible career, and the like, in the process of implementing these ethically commanded equal rights. It is only when we put the matter in that context that it becomes possible to see what very different values underlie the Negro insistence on total and immediate desegregation and much of the white resistance to desegregation on the other hand. For we have at stake here not alone different views on the same values, but also very different values in conflict. For the Negro, it is all too clear. Separate schools publicly symbolize degradation. However more comfortable a Negro child may be with other Negroes, however easier it may be for him psychologically in some ways to stay in his ghetto, and there is comfort in one's ghetto, the fact remains that for those who are insisting that this comfort shall not be a major consideration are doing so on the grounds that the existence of segregated schools is an unjustifiable and intolerable insult, and one that hurts bitterly and deeply, hurts the parents as much, if not more, than the children. If this is realized, then it follows that no one who wishes to have a hearing in the Negro community can possibly hope to get such a hearing and to have his sincerity even assumed for even a moment, unless he demonstrates in some convincing way that he is fully aware of how fundamentally insulting and ego-damaging it is to Negroes to have segregated schools. And no program for desegregation of the schools is likely to be entertained by the Negroes if it does not give to the need to remove this insult the highest possible priority among all other values that may be at stake. Now, one of the more saddening things about the current state of Negro-white relationships, especially in the large urban centers in the North, is the extent to which many Negroes seem to have resolved on principle that no white can possibly feel the insulting character of segregation as deeply as do Negroes, and therefore that no white can possibly be sincere in his determination to remove this insult. Not only is this line of thought saddening, it is damaging to the common cause of democratic society. It drives away lies. It is factually simply wrong, since there are obviously many whites who, for a number of reasons, are more ready for total and immediate desegregation than many Negroes. And while some of the reasons they are ready may not please many of the Negroes, it seems to me utterly wrong to reject this support because it is not totally pure in heart. Third, it only serves to reinforce the cleavage between whites and Negroes and to engender increasingly false and bitter stereotypes which each group has about the other. And thereby, it decreases the possibilities of relatively quick and relatively peaceful solutions to a problem that common welfare demands shall be solved as totally and quickly as possible. Now, it would be fatally wrong to underestimate the extent to which segments of the Negro community place the highest and maybe the solitary value on the total and immediate removal of the public symbol of degradation that segregated schools represent. And lest anyone think that this feeling and sentiment are inappropriate, let him or her imagine for just a moment what he would feel like if the situation was reversed. Suppose you were in the comparable situation. Suppose every day you saw your children going off to schools that contained only or predominantly other children of your own ethnic or national or other group that was, you knew, considered inferior and undesirable as a group. Suppose, therefore, every day you saw your child acquiring a deeper sense of his difference and of the shame that necessarily pours into this difference. How much sympathy would you have for a proposal that in effect said, look here, wait a while, wait a few years. We'll give you and your kind and your kids a chance at equality, but not now and not too quickly. So go and make yourselves more ready and suitable and prove yourselves more worthy, and then we'll talk about giving you equality, but not now. How long would anyone here in the audience put up with that kind of arrant nonsense if he thought he could, by his actions, speed up the tempo of change, or even if he thought it wouldn't make any difference, but so long as he thought he ought to go out and say so? Understanding of that kind that sympathetic identification can produce will help make clear, without necessarily meaning that you will approve, will help make clear at least the source of Negro militants and also why it is that the removal of the insult and degradation is so important and so urgent as to make some of the Negro leadership willing to say that no education is better than segregated education and that desegregation at the so-called expensive education represents no problem to them at all. Since this has been the stand of some of the more militant segment of the community, and since this has seemed so outrageously irresponsible to most whites and even to many Negroes, it is important, I think, that we should at least understand the source of this point of view. In turn now, it seems to me equally urgent that the sources of white resistance to the demand for total and immediate desegregation should also be made clear. Let us admit from the outset that substantial elements of anti-Negro prejudice are involved for many of those who resist, just as substantial portions of anti-white prejudice are present in the Negro demands. Let's admit that, but let's recognize that it would be fatally wrong, at least I think so, to insist that this prejudice is the primary motivation of all white resistors, or that it was the strongest motivation among those who, while prejudiced, also hold other grounds for their resistance. The fact of the matter is that because of the extraordinary importance that success in education has come to assume in American life, because of the extraordinary amount of competition for good education that has arisen, because of the extraordinary amount of concern for status and the way in which we have made our children hostages in the competition for status, for these reasons, among others, much of the white community, including the so-called liberal portion of that community, has found it most difficult, easily and readily, to accept the Negro demands. All their basic material interests are at stake and subject to injury, as they perceive it, as many do, if this demand is met. If Negro children, they reason, are now injured by segregation, the whites feel their children may be injured by desegregation. If elimination of insulting segregation is therefore the highest priority of the Negro community, the maintenance of good schools, which are often, of course, wrongly identified as such, is the highest priority for the white community. If Negroes have suffered serious injustice for several hundred years, many in the white community see no good ground to attempt today to compensatorily correct this injustice at what they consider to be great cost to themselves and their children. In taking this stand, however understandable it may be, however, the white community often makes some serious mistakes of fact and of theory. In the first instance, there has grown widespread the notion that any significant increase in the Negro population of a school is likely to cause that school to deteriorate in the quality of the education it provides. But this is true only to the extent, and it may be the most frequent case, but it's true only to the extent that the school authorities do not provide for the kind of integration of new children into a school that makes sense, namely putting school children at levels of instruction of which they are capable and teaching them in accordance with their abilities of the moment, advancing them here and there as their capabilities are cultivated and reinforced. And that goes for all children, Negro or white. We shall later speak of what's required if this is to be done well, but for the moment, let it be noted that the idea that there is an automatic deterioration of schools with an introduction of a larger number of Negro children has no inherent truth to it. It all depends on how the integration is accomplished. What provisions are made for handling whatever greater diversity may be being introduced into the schools? The second major error that many members of the white community make is the assumption that delaying desegregation until that mythical point when Negroes are more ready, whatever that means, will make desegregation easier later on. But ladies and gentlemen, it's quite evident that every single day of delay in making some start makes every subsequent day somewhat more difficult. The same reminder must be placed before that segment of the Negro community, and it is substantial, that would just as soon apparently settle for segregated schools so long as something effective is done about making them better schools. Now, it's quite true that one can make any school a better school even if it's totally segregated. And it's therefore true that so far as good schooling is instrumental for good advanced schooling, and that in turn for good jobs, any number of Negroes can count on using the school, segregated or not, as an instrument of economic and social improvement that it has always proven to be to some extent in the past. But it's equally true that so long as segregated communities and schools exist, that long does the idea of the separateness of Negro from white get reinforcement. And that long, therefore, is the goal of equal opportunity delayed. Since in both the short and the long run, the ideal of equally good education for all, regardless of origin or ability, cannot really become a normal, easy practice so long as there are recognizably separate communities of Negroes and whites, it is urgent that the separation be reduced as quickly and as completely as possible. We shall not really be able to do what is imperative, namely, to think of children as children and to stop thinking and perceiving them as Negro and white children until they so naturally interact in every normal situation of social intercourse as to make any attempt to think of them separately simply useless and purposeless. Now, the white community or many members make a third error. It's a reflection of the old and recently reinforced notion, and in this the Negro community shares to some extent, the idea that the best education ought to be reserved for the most talented children. Now, this is an elitist notion which has no justification either in fact or in democratic theory. Our school system from the beginning has been dedicated to providing equally good education to all students, regardless not only of differences in color or creed, but regardless of differences in talent. It seems to me an abomination beyond defense to insist that the best teachers, the best facilities, and the greatest material resources ought to be poured into the special education of a talented elite. On what conceivable grounds? I'm speaking now of the public schools of the United States and of the kind of education we think that our children are entitled to. And while we ordinarily hear mostly the clamor for the special education of on top the most talented and on bottom the most crippled children, Somehow the idea of special education for that large number in between never seems to take hold. If we insist, as we should, that all our children must go to school for 12 years or till the age of 16, and with luck we may raise it to 18 and to 20, to 40 and to 80, can we possibly justify the stand, if we insist on compulsory education, the stand that says some of these children shall get better education and some shall get worse education? Now, there are two grounds on which this stand has been rationalized, namely, you should have better education for talented kids. The first has something to do with the simple-minded kind of Rickover Cold War approach to schooling, which argues that the need to cultivate and favor the talented elite in order to turn out the technicians needed to compete with the Soviet in the Cold War, that's the highest priority. Well, maybe we do, but no one has ever shown that attuning the school to the special education of the talented kids who are going to become engineers will yield you a higher product of this kind, even of that that you want, without at the same time totally destroying the whole fabric of liberal education about which presumably we're conducting the Cold War. Now, the second ground on which some have tried to justify the idea of special education for talented kids has to do with the special needs of such children. But that, too, is a curious concept, because can anyone say that there is any child who doesn't have equally special needs? The average child has them. The below-average child has them. The mongoloid child has them. The genius child has them. And that's just what the common school ideal had in mind, that all children have special needs and all should be attended to equally. If we look at this idea of talent for a moment, some very interesting fallacies in ordinary reasoning appear. Let's suppose first that the most talented kids are that way because they've had special cultural advantages. To urge, therefore, that we ought with public funds to increase those advantages by providing them with better education than others is clearly immoral and contrary to every sound principle of democratic society. But let's suppose for a moment that those talented children are that way as a result of superior native endowment. To urge then that they should get better ed schooling is to urge that the society, with its public funds, should especially favor children who happen to have had a lucky accident of birth. And this idea is anathema to every democratic principle we have lived by since the end of feudalism. Finally, if the brighter children are that way by some combination of greater native endowment and greater cultural advantage, some combination of the two, then to urge that they should get better schooling than other kids is doubly violative of every sound principle of democracy. In short, there is no conceivable justification in theory for such special education for the more talented children. Now, if you try to give a factual basis to this contention and resort to some notion that children will come out better, educationally speaking, if they are taught in some version of homogeneous groups or tracking, then you must turn to the evidence and to ask whether there is evidence that will show that there are better educational results for everyone concerned in homogeneous grouping or in heterogeneous grouping of children. The argument here gets complicated by such factors as the number of children in the classroom. And there are too many classrooms in which it doesn't matter whether you have homogeneous groups or heterogeneous groups. You might just as well not have them. The quality of the teacher, and there are any number of teachers. Again, it doesn't much matter whether you have homogeneous or heterogeneous groups. They'll do just as badly or just as well in either of them. And the problem is complicated by the ability to handle diversity and the like. And again, that ability is randomly distributed through the teaching population and doesn't seem to much matter. Now, we recognize these complicating factors, but if we take them into account, it's quite clear, judging from the best research scholarship on the matter, that the educational output of homogeneous versus heterogeneous groupings is perhaps the most unsettled matter in all of educational theory. As Harry Passau and others have shown in their reviews of the research literature, the results are extremely diverse. Sometimes the slower kids profit, and the faster kids are hurt by homogeneous grouping. Sometimes the reverse occurs. Sometimes nobody benefits. Sometimes everyone does. And we don't know the varying circumstances under which these occur. There's no clear-cut indication at all as to the superiority or inferiority from the viewpoint of narrow educational targets of either form of grouping children. What is abundantly clear is that homogeneous grouping helps decisively to generate an anti-democratic school atmosphere, that it brands and stigmatizes the slower groups in this culture, where speed and higher mental capacity are considered such important mental values, and calling them wrens and bluebirds doesn't hide a thing, because everyone knows who the wrens are and who the bluebirds are and who flies and who doesn't fly. You can't euphemize your way out of children's perceptions and sensitivities. You can't disguise the facts of life to them. They know quicker than their parents what these groupings mean. And they don't use wrens and bluebirds. They talk about stupid kids. We know also that grouping serves decisively to lock up children, to lock them up in their ability groupings, which were ill-conceived in the first place in most instances, being based often on tests that haven't been changed in 30 years, being based on some perception of capacity, which is the pencil and paper response of a given moment to a given set of pencil and paper stimuli, from which is inferred some notion of global native intelligence. The groupings lock up the children, and they ensure that they will get taught in terms of the dominant image of them that is created by those groupings, so that slow children get taught as slow children and get made slower. The best result I've ever heard reported about using groupings as a way to facilitate the movement of children out of groupings is a report that over a period of 1 year, 10% of the kids who had been assigned to the slow and the medium groups had been moved up to the fast group. There is no conceivable measurement of human capacity in the world that could so accurately identify capacities within a 10% error target. None. The assumption must be that if you moved only 10%, that those are the only 10 who really were misplaced in the first place. In this way, with this kind of grouping, we can be sure that differences between kids at any one moment are guaranteed to be increased at the next moment by the very operations of the school itself. This is especially true when the so-called good teaching is rewarded by having the good teachers assigned to the faster groups, and when teachers are considered degraded when they are assigned to slower groups to teach on some nutty notion that slower kids don't need as good teachers as faster kids. Now let me pause to tell you the results of a series of experiments that were conducted at Harvard by a very bright young professor there who was concerned with the extent to which prior definition and labeling of the probable outcome would affect that outcome. A series of 30 tests were performed on two groups who had been pre-selected in such a way that there was distributed through them totally equal capacity for performance on a series of standard tests. They were randomized. Two equally good groups, equally bad, equally good. The experimenters who were to administer the tests to the two groups were told as follows. One group of experimenters was told, now don't say anything about this, but you have a bunch of kids who are considerably brighter than the average, and their scores ought to range about from here to here, and the score range was from minus 20 to plus 20. They ought to range between 10 and 20. A few might be between 10 and 5, but the most going to be between 10 and 20. And the experimenters who were supposed to work with the so-called slow group were told, you have a bunch of kids who aren't very fast and aren't very good and aren't very smart. Don't let them know, but probably your results will range somewhere between 0 and minus 5, some of them dropping between 5 and 10, maybe 10 to 20 on the negative side. Then they ran 30 tests on a variety of performances. And ladies and gentlemen, not a single score of the group that was defined as slow reached the point of the lowest score made by anybody in the group that was defined as high. Not a single score. I'm not saying there was overlapping. I'm saying there was no overlapping in the scores. And these two groups were selected beforehand for complete equality of range of performance. The scoring was pushed to the extremes by the operation of experimenter bias, and when they asked the variety of ways in which this experimenter bias worked, the single most important probable result contribution to the bias was the unconscious falsification of the scoring by the experimenters. Unconscious falsification in order that the score should come out in accordance with the way they were told they should probably come out. Other sources of bias have been investigated. Some of them were conscious falsifications by those who had most ego investment in getting approval from the man who was running the experiment, but that was not the majority of the cases. The majority was unconscious falsification in the actual scoring and in the adding of simple numbers. This is the result of having a preconception of what the ability level of the people in front of you happens to be. Especially if that notion is passed on, defined such a way, especially if it proves useful to the teacher to be able to identify talents beforehand. And especially if there's enough camaraderie among teachers so that as the kids move from one class to the other in the semesters or during the year, the word is passed on, that's the B'nai group, that's the good one, so on. Now let's try to put a little more sanity into this madhouse of educational procedures. It's quite clear, isn't it, that the idea of grouping children according to their talents is done out of the best of motives. We want to teach each child as much as possible in accordance with his ability to learn. So the motive is good. The motive is individuation of education, and that's surely the highest goal of democratic educational theory. Grouping into bundles of talent is an effort to approximate this goal. It says we'll recognize not individual children, but three kinds of children, slow, medium, and fast. And that's as close as we can come, given the limited resources, to individuating education in our overcrowded and understaffed schools. Unfortunately, this well-intentioned idea has become its own Frankenstein. Not only has it not resulted in any greater approximation at individuation, it has rather served to reinforce, all too often, and to harden the unpleasant stereotypes regarding disadvantaged children and to make them even greater goats, and all this by action of public policy with public funds. Now, one must conclude, therefore, that in view of the identifiable losses to personal dignity, to democratic values, and to the future potentials of children, and in the absence of any significant evidence that homogeneous grouping yields you greater educational output, such grouping practices ought to be discontinued immediately except on the most tentative experimental basis. And experimentation, it seems to me, is eminently reasonable, but not mass policy adoption. And this we shall see if we explore it later in the session and question period. To really work a school system without homogeneous groupings requires also the elimination of the notion of first, second, third, and fourth years, and requires absolutely the elimination of competitive grades. Now, I've taken this kind of digression into school policy because it seems to me to lie at the heart of white fears regarding their children and at the heart of Negro fears regarding their children. And it also points up quite poignantly and dramatically, I think, how many other values are necessarily involved in any decision about school policy other than the so-called educational output as measured in test performance. Now, I've tried to illustrate during the course of these past remarks a number of fallacies and errors in the thinking and debating about desegregation, especially as it focuses on the schools. There's the fallacy of thinking that one can identify native talents, and that these talents are distributed differently according to skin color lines. There's a fallacy that the evidence on a given matter, such as race differences, is not perfect, it's no good at all. There's a fallacy that one can expect to receive support for a program of schools and school reform that's predicated on the solitary and highest importance of one interest of one limited group. There's a contrary but equally pernicious fallacy that resistance to the proposed reforms can possibly be justified without taking into account the highest and most important values of the other groups concerned. There's a pervasive fallacy among Negroes and whites alike that if you're not 100% with them, you are ipso facto 100% against them. There is a common failure to recognize that overall school policies in any sane democracy must reflect a concern for common welfare and the goals of democratic education, and that therefore the school policy cannot fully reflect the total and exclusive interests of one or another group, but must always represent some degree of compromise among conflicting interests. If the school board is thought of as the agency for the mediation of these competing interests and demands, and as the agency responsible for formulating what it considers to be the best program that most serves the common interest, then the school board and others must recognize, it seems to me, that they cannot possibly be met with favor by all the competing interests. They must always be looked upon at any given moment as representing the interests of one group more than another. The school board nor any other administrative executive agency dare hope to receive love and affection and gratitude from its constituents. No parent in his right mind ever expects gratitude from his children. In fact, the principle of inverse reciprocity works. For every good deed done, one can expect 3 kicks in the pants, unless otherwise impelled. The school board seemingly must always be subject and expected to be subject to attack, cannot afford to play around with hurt feelings, and must welcome some of this attack, at least to the extent that it is thereby informed of the public reaction feeling about its latest bad decisions. And all its decisions are bad, at least as viewed by one or more of the parties concerned, though surely the parties will take turns in viewing the decision as bad or good. So it's only through the forcible representation of points of view that competing publics can hope to get their interests given attention by those who make policy. If some do this through the power structure because they have access to it, while others are forced into picket lines and to lie-downs and sit-ins to make their point, that's probably unavoidable and probably positively functional for the political health of the community. School boards ought not to expect people not to lie down in their chambers to protest decisions if those people feel there's no other way to make their point clear. As a corollary, those who lie down in school board rooms ought not to expect not to get hauled off and arrested for disturbing the peace when they lie down. The path toward resolution of competing demands is at least, I think, roughly and approximately indicated. No plan can be expected to be even partially satisfactory to everyone concerned if it does not take into account some degree of recognition of what are the highest priorities of both the Negro and the white community. Nor can any decision or policy be expected to receive any acceptance if it thinks only along those lines and does not firmly and boldly insist on programming public education in accordance with some vision of what such schooling ideally should be. The white community cannot expect the Negro community to be patient with segregation on any grounds, however much it might reasonably expect the Negro community to accept, though grudgingly, some reasonable timetable. The Negro community, in turn, cannot expect the white community to accept any plan which focuses alone on the removal of the stigma of segregation and explicitly disregards all other educational considerations which may be of the highest salience for the white community. It is on these apparently irreconcilable but actually reconcilable demands that the conflict now centers. Can anyone seriously doubt that a working resolution or resolutions will be evolved, some more attuned to short-run results and some to the long-run goals? Yes, I think one can have serious doubts, to the extent that one also doubts that the community, you and I, will be willing to pay the taxes and provide the resources necessary to these resolutions. Obviously, to do something effective about the quality of school buildings, the quality of teachers, the quality of programs, of remedial and other extracurricular services, all these are going to require much more personnel, much more training, much more building, much more of everything than is now possible for the schools to do with their limited resources. So it is first upon the community at large to be willing to pay and pay and pay. It is secondly imperative on both the Negro and white communities that they perceive clearly and fully what each community considers to be most important. and that they commonly perceive the extent to which any attempt to have only their individual interests served dominantly or exclusively will either wreck the school system or the community or both. It is, I think, totally wrong to say that no school system is better than what we have. It is also totally wrong to think that this can be solved by pitched battles in the street or by marches en masse on the Board of Education protesting the end of desegregation, the end of segregation. It may be politically strategic and persuasive to close the schools during a one-day boycott or to march on the Board of Education protesting desegregation, but to see these as long-range things, as long-range goals, is a nightmare that's destructive of everyone's interests. I'm persuaded, ladies and gentlemen, that we are commonly enough dedicated to democratic goals, that we're commonly enough sufficiently concerned with high-quality education for all our kids, that we're sufficiently interested in total community welfare, enough of us are, to be able to move to the necessary compromises, and compromises they must be, with some greater degree of respect and understanding of each other's desires and interests than has been apparent in the last several years here in New York and throughout the country. Indeed, no other perspective is possible, it seems to me, if we're to make any serious effort that has any chance of success at ransoming our children out of the status of hostages in which we have collectively placed them.